Face World Media. I feel like I haven't really gone live in a little while at this point. So wherever you are in this world, and if you're working, not working, eating lunch, really welcome here. I am talking to Ian Naj. I like to say his last name correctly, which is Rudin. I believe you're originally from California, but your parents, your heritage is rooted in Hungary. So Hungary. And so this is, am I saying correct? Ian, is you're Hungarian, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm born and raised in California, but yeah, I'm also a Hungarian citizen and my last name is Hungarian. And I can't even say it right. So
I was kind of guessing like, yeah. Nagy, so that's also correct.
Works for me.
It's so interesting because I interview and go live with different people and kind of moderate these webinars. This is the part that I always trying to get right with people, and then yet people, especially people who are immigrants, come from like very multicultural backgrounds, are very forgiving, but I always want to make an effort to say it correctly. So welcome to the show. I'm so glad that we arranged this months ago, and today is the day to go live.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thank you for being on our podcast. And I can't wait for our very slow process to finally, you know, put it live so we can share what we were able to talk about. So thank you so much for continuing the conversation.
Oh, thank you for your time, for being here. And I want to quickly introduce you, and there's so much I still want to learn about you, your work, your origins. So for people who don't know about Ian, so check out VidTao, that is VIDTAO.com. Is that correct? I hope I'm right.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of .co and AI these days. It's .com. And I find this conversation going to be very interesting and educational for me, is because, you know, Ian has a long history in understanding how to effectively run ads. In this case, VidTao is designed to help you optimize on YouTube, so YouTube advertising. Mm-hmm. And we want to really gear towards this conversation towards people who can relate to what Ian has done, what I have done. So you don't have to be a multi 7-8-9 figure business. Instead, if you have something like $300, $500 to spend each month, which isn't a lot for advertising, we still want to talk to you and welcome your questions here and see what we can do to help you understand how to leverage and how to optimize the budget you already have. And with that said, Ian, the reason why I find it super interesting is because I learned about your work through your outreach to me to be on your show. And very quickly, I realized VidTao has now over 100,000 users, and you're very transparent, very humble about your beginning. So I really want to take this opportunity for people to really listen in. What is it like to start a software company, other types of businesses you've started, how to really live with and persevere through, you know, success as well as failures. And so welcome to the show. Can I drop a first question for you?
Thank you for having me. And yeah, absolutely.
For the intro. So I would love for you to maybe talk to us at a high level, like when you approach people for the first time, what is it that you do and what is VidTao about?
Yeah, so I mean, fundamentally, I would say that I'm in the business of performance advertising. So basically being able to, you know, take an action and then observe how that action results in other people taking actions. So whether that's putting out a piece of content organically, or video organically, or a piece of paid content where you're putting money behind it and saying, I want to show this piece of content to these people on a platform like Meta, you know, Facebook, Instagram, or Google, whatever the case may be, just essentially it's observing, making experiments in human behavior and trying to, you know, fundamentally trying to provide some value to people and seeing how that value resonates in terms of money coming, taking an action, what kind of action comes back, and, you know, from the business perspective, what kind of money comes back from that action.
Yeah, very. I like how straightforward you make it to be. And I think there's so many ways to break that down for people who are listening. Number one, I did realize last night when I was setting this up, is how to diversify your revenue, not diversity. I corrected in the live stream platform, but it's somehow still streaming that way. I'll be sure to correct it on social media. You know, I already did, I think, on YouTube and LinkedIn. So sorry about that. I definitely want to catch up and kind of break it down on this, Ian, about the content that you're talking about. A lot of people think about ads, they're thinking about purely advertising, but truly is the content that's behind it when we started working here at Face World, when we started working with a few clients on advertising for, particularly for Facebook, originally before that was Google Ads. These days, a little bit of LinkedIn ads, which I've kind of have very mixed feelings there, that people think is just ads or just text. In fact, a lot of that has to do with videos, short form videos, videos of different orientations or aspect ratios, you know, vertical, square, landscape and cover art and call to action. There's a lot going on. So before our call that you mentioned, the idea or the importance of really knowing how to create content that resonates with people. There's a lot of different practices that we have done in different areas, such as email marketing being one of them, but even just creating content where Instagram Reels, like getting started creating content that resonates with people. So I would love for you to talk about the importance of content, how to create, you know, magnets or like how to create content that actually sticks and then surface to the top.
Yeah, no, totally. It's a great question. I think it comes down to understanding the needs of the people who you're trying to talk to. So the more you're in the space yourself, or if you're coming from outside that space, having conversations, understanding the challenges that people face, and then that allows you to see opportunities to help, really. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in my eyes, I mean, so content's been a huge part of our business from on the software side in terms of just building a really big email list and a really engaged email list that we can communicate with, understand challenges they have, and then basically provide paid solutions to, whether that's software or services. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it starts with understanding the challenges and then, you know, trying to be helpful and provide useful, actionable, interesting. And I would say nowadays, as the barrier to entry for content becomes less and less with a lot of AI, mm-hmm. it becomes more about, you know, cutting through the noise and actually providing unique insights. So, it's entertainment and utility together
mm-hmm.
in the context of understanding your audience's problems. That's kind of the overall framework for useful content. And that content can be simply to build a relationship. It can be to actually initiate, let's say, you know, deepening that relationship, going from viewer to actual subscriber mm-hmm. and then subscriber to customer. And then that content can actually be something that people pay for in order to actually, you know, get a very prescribed formula, whatever, to apply mm-hmm. and then seek some kind of result. So that's kind of high level how I look at content.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I'm going to use VidTao as an example because a lot of the questions I get from entrepreneurs, especially creators and small business owners, is that we are people who are very excitable, have a lot of energy, and you know, many of us are running more than one business at a time. So for me, you know, I have a few that I'm focusing on. Now, people really struggle. I'm sure you probably remember from when you were starting out as well, to really how to get an idea off the ground. So could you maybe talk to us a little bit about the beginning of VidTao? Has it always been what it is today? Did you guys have to pivot? And how did you find traction?
Yeah. So I'll definitely walk through that story in a sec, but I just wanted to throw out a public service announcement from my own experience is basically be careful investing your time and your money in an idea that you think is really good before you get any kind of feedback from other people who are willing to pay for that idea. That it has value. You know, if you are intending to make it a business, of course, you're doing it for its own sort of benefits and as a passion apart from business. That's a whole other conversation. But every time that I've failed at stuff, it's always been because I've gotten kind of obsessed with my own, you know, my own thing and not actually field tested it. Whereas like for VidTao, VidTao is a YouTube ad library. It's actually a really simple idea. Basically, it's for advertisers on YouTube, and YouTube, as we all know, those annoying ads that pop up before the video you actually want to watch. That's what our agency does. We make those ads, we run them, we show them to the audiences who we want to show them to, and businesses pay us to do all that. So we're nerds about ads. So we want to understand, hey, who's running what? What is, you know, Grammarly running, and what can we learn from that? And how well are those ads doing? Is there any indication of how that those ads are doing. So the way we started was just the most simple thing possible. We figured out a way to manually grab these ads and make a spreadsheet for our own internal use. So super simple MVP, right? The intention was never to, hey, this is going to be another business. It was more about, this is solving a problem that we had ourselves. So we're documenting all these ads, we're tracking them manually. And then at a certain point, you know, we realized, oh, we should actually make a software that allows us to do this better and at a higher scale so that we have more data and we can understand the landscape even better. So it's kind of like initial step and then the, you know, investment of time and brain power and money emerged from a natural need of, hey, this is, for us at least, it's providing some value and we want to make it even better so that we can use it. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the starting point. Back to the PSA, yeah, just beware of premature optimization, I guess is another way of putting it. Like don't, you know, it would be stupid of us, would have been stupid of us to invest like $100,000 that, you know, we didn't have at that point and make some kind of full-fledged slick software. So we just built a little spreadsheet for our own internal use, literally a Google sheet. And then that's how we started the software. And then from there, you know, we said, hey, let's make an actual software out of this and hired a software agency to help us do that, made the user interface in literally in Google Sheets. So like just use a spreadsheet to kind of mock up what was going to be where. And then that's kind of how we got started. Me and my business partner, Brett, we sat in his apartment in Valencia in Spain and just worked on that. And so yeah, that's high level kind of the beginnings of our software.
Yeah, this is super, super fascinating. And for people who are watching this, I know that there are some of you are actively watching on LinkedIn. Sorry, we can't really see you live, but if you drop a question, we'll certainly get to that. Is that we are kind of touching upon the concept of MVP, minimal viable product. By the way, that's not just, I don't see that term isolated to software projects alone, but I think about it as a podcast, you know, maybe an SEO project or, you know, your new blog, whatever it is that you may be doing, even your YouTube channel. So Ian, could you maybe talk to us about what was MVP look like to you? Because people sometimes struggle to either wait too long or not wait long enough. You know, waiting too long means suddenly, you know, your idea is no longer relevant or there are too many, there are other people already beating you to the competition. They launched first. So could you help us understand how to balance that, too early or too late?
Yeah. So, you know, we're streaming on LinkedIn, right? So it's Reid Hoffman, I think, had this saying, it's if you're not embarrassed with the first iteration of your product that you release, then you launch too late. So point, and some people disagree with that now because of certain things, but I think it's still a really good rule of thumb. And it's just so many of us are perfectionists and, you know, struggle with like getting something perfectly polished before you feel like it's ready to release to the world. And I do think it's a mistake because, you know, when we release something to the world, it's not really for us. Usually it's for other people. And the only way to really, the real polishing that should be done is actually getting that user feedback and then iterating based on that feedback and seeing how it actually you know, exists in the whole ecosystem of whatever it's trying to do. So I think that's how I'd like to think about MVP. And as you mentioned, it's not just about software. It's about, you know, like let's say you're doing a new type of service, a new piece of type of content, or even a piece of content. Like, hey, I want to do a three-part series on this particular topic. What if I just did a tweet about it and saw how the, you know, how the engagement is? And then based on that, then you can build, decide to continue to build it or just pause that for now, put it in the back burner.
I'm curious, now you have 100,000 users on vidtao.com. What was that trajectory like? How many years, it just give kind of people a sense of how many years have you been working on it? When did the first MVP launch? And when was the tipping point, you know, going from, you know, dripping of like 1-2 users a day, maybe, and then suddenly it took off. What are some of the efforts and kind of the tipping points involved in the process?
Yeah, for sure. So it hasn't been instant. So I think 2019, we actually made the first piece of software that that Zwittau.
Nearly 5 years ago.
Yeah, almost 5 years ago. So it was in parallel with our, we have a video advertising agency called Inceptly that Brad and I co-founded and that we continue to run. And so yeah, it was just to kind of assist that. So, and then this year, you know, we launched a whole new version of the software. It's a total rebuild. It's massively enhanced all these different things. But yeah, in terms of the user trajectory, so we got an initial, because Brad and I were both really involved in performance marketing, had a lot of, or, you know, had some colleagues, other advertising nerds. We just shared what we were making. Hey, check this out. And then there was an initial buzz for sure. I don't remember the exact numbers, but, you know, we got some, it wasn't, you know, we didn't launch to crickets really. So we, because we had already built these relationships and we already identified this need. And so we had a little, I guess you could say, a core beta tester group that really was excited to try out the software. And
how big was that group? I'm just curious.
I mean, I don't think more than a few dozen people really.
Okay.
So it was pretty small, but, and we just, you know, we were in different groups, Slack channels, private communities and stuff. We just said, hey, check this out. It's free. Try it out. It solves this particular, you know, this particular need. Give it a whirl and let us know what you think really. And, yeah. And then from there, you know, it just started growing and growing. And then, you know, it's become a really incredible organic growth engine for our business because it just sits there and we get, you know, dozens of people every day, if not more than that, significantly, just showing up and signing up to our email list. And then we can, you know, they buy, now it's, we have a paid part of the software. So we have a total paid component. We did it for several years. But that software just grew an amazing email list that we communicate with. We've had an incredible live event that we did in at Oxford University a couple of years back. And so just made a lot of relationships. And then our agency business has really been able to grow in large part, you know, not entirely from the software, but it's definitely helped a lot to in terms of lead flow and stuff like that. And I just want to say one thing too, because I know a lot of people on the call are thinking like, oh, you know, software sounds so difficult and like, oh, it's not really relevant to me. I would encourage you to rethink that. So, and the whole thing, like, what is software anyways? It's a way of, it's a way of solving a problem, making it, solving a problem easier than it is to do manually. So it's just kind of automating something fundamentally and assisting you to doing something like Word, Microsoft Word is simply like it, instead of typing it or writing it, it's making all that digital. So it's not conceptually, it's just solving it, solving a problem. So I'd encourage you to think about problems that whatever you're into business wise or personal wise, think about problems, simple problems, like very small MVP, right? Very small incremental problems that you think would be, could be interesting to solve that might be useful to you and then other people in your situation. And now more than ever, it's easier than ever to create software, you know, thanks to AI. Explore that. I think it can be a really powerful additional leg to stand on to diversify your revenue, really, no matter whatever you're doing. So just something to brainstorm.
I would love to definitely get into AI in just a bit, because I think this past year has been a little crazy. I think the word crazy was used on several phone calls, including one I was on today. There are a lot of instabilities, a lot of changes happening. Something that I feel like we are lucky to have lived that life as an entrepreneur for the past 10 years, eight precisely from when we formed the LLC. So we've seen a lot of ups and downs in our own businesses and our clients' businesses. So, but at the same time, right, AI, as in the age we're living in, suddenly people who didn't make a lot of money, they are, you know, becoming, you know, millionaires or, you know, starting their own agencies. And people who used to make a lot of money, have very stable careers, and suddenly they now fear that they might lose it, not temporarily, but forever. So if you guys have any thoughts or questions, I would love to see that in comments. But before we get into that, I want to just comment on something you said about solving a specific problem. What was it about existing YouTube advertising platforms and tools that were already there? You know, YouTube as of 2019 certainly wasn't a brand new idea. There were a lot of tools on the market today. You know, we use, from an SEO perspective, we use TubeBuddy. I know VidIQ is out there as well. What made you, what is the the problem that only Vitel could solve? And what are some of the pain points that you felt like you had to create this tool?
Yeah, I don't think there was, when we launched it, I might be misremembering, but I don't think there was another tool specifically focused on basically spotting on YouTube advertising specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something that didn't exist. I remember feeling a lot of urgency around, oh, we need to get this, you know, we get this out because other people are going to do it. In the end, other people did it. There are other businesses that did this exact same thing that we did.
Mm-hmm.
And which in the end doesn't really matter. You know, I mean, it is what it is. Like, if it's a good idea, it's almost like, you know, I think people are scared of competition, but mm-hmm. I think competition is a good sign that, you know, yes, it's good to be early to market,
mm-hmm.
Blue ocean, blah, blah, blah. But in the end, it's a sign that you're on the right track. So yeah, the problem we solved was there's no real big index of all the unlisted YouTube advertisements
mm-hmm.
and how they're actually performing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we wanted to know that for our own good as advertisers, is one that we're one of the biggest, YouTube advertising agencies around. So, we just needed to know that to actually help our clients get results.
Yeah. So yeah, that's super fascinating. And, I don't know, Vitel well enough. I started playing with it since our last conversation. I found it really interesting, especially when you said the spying part as an understanding, like what these brands are doing, right? Most people, like even for us as people who work in the industry, it will be hard for us to say, okay, you know, Natalie, check it out. This is what Nike's doing. Even, you know, maybe some more relevant brands, I wouldn't even know what this XYZ company is doing. I don't have no idea how to get to those ads that are currently running or it ran before, you know, what channel they're on. So it's really fascinating. Could you maybe help us understand what are, if there's any AI elements to it, like how you guys leveraging AI or any specific tactics or approach for you to get to the results that you need?
Yeah, so I would say that, I guess you could say there are a lot of tools that are way more integrated with AI, but I would say one of the biggest things that's really interesting that AI has opened up is the idea of basically quantifying semantic meaning. So there's something called vector embeddings where basically you can take, and I know, Faye, you have an AI business of your own, so
we're all learning here.
So I'm probably butchering a lot of the terminology and the sort of concepts, but basically with it, vector embeddings, you can take any kind of chunk of text and you can turn it into, let's say, like a 1500 string or 1500 place vector. So 1500 different little numbers
mm-hmm.
that then it quantifies, it basically takes meaning, like the meaning of words, and then makes a number out of it. And then that allows you to do interesting things like, say, I want to search for an ad that has to do with like Nike or shoes or something. And then it's going to pull up all the ads have to do with shoes, even if they don't say, oh, this is about shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And then now with images, the same thing. So it's not just about text. It's about, you know, what's actually in the image. So I guess classification and search are really powerful applications for that kind of technology on one side. And then also, you know, the generative AI is pretty obvious. So in our tool, we have generative AI tools where you can basically, for instance, you can take a video and then, this is not the core of our tool, but this is stuff that we've built and as help our audience. Mm-hmm. Basically, for instance, you can take a video and you can generate new hooks for it. So new little 5 to 10 second intros, new ideas for the hooks based on what's there, both visually and also audio. So what's being said and what's being shown. Mm-hmm. The AI, you know, like GPT-4 vision at this point, can look and see what's being shown frame by frame and then say, okay, this is what's on the screen. Based on what we've seen success with in these other videos, here are some new ideas for you to test, and then, you know, presenting that to our user.
By the way, is that, just so I understand, is that an existing feature from Vitel, or this is?
Yeah, that's in there. It might be hard to find, but yeah, it's in there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, that's such a great use case of AI. I was literally right before this, I was creating some videos for Adobe Express and to see how generative AI, for instance, could add objects that currently do not exist in an image of yours, where you can remove elements very easily. And just learning from that pattern was really interesting. So kind of related to what you just said, giving context even to generative AI is important. So similar to prompts, you know, more context you can give to it, the better output it will be. I noticed when I was playing with Adobe Express's like generative AI or generative fill tool, it was a little hamster running on, you know, in the living room, and it was like a remote control. And what I wanted to do was just remove the remote control. But instead of just coloring over the remote control, I actually use a tool brush to cover over the floor. So now AI understands contextually what is not just that one piece of remote control, but what's near it. It was like repainting it perfectly. And it was just so interesting. Like in my mind, it's like I think there is always like maybe a little bit of a missing step in education to people to understand like, what does context really mean in this case? How can you really take advantage of AI? Now, I mean, I certainly any reflections you have for what I just said, but I think a lot of people and a lot of the content I've been producing on this channel has been about AI can be very powerful if you use it correctly. At the same time, what is your advice or maybe some of the conversations that you've been in, because you've been very open-minded, you're a software guy now, and this is the world that you live in. Like when you approach people, someone, imagine you care about who is really struggling, maybe currently out of a job because of AI, we're semi-related, adjacent to the issue that we're talking about. What would be your advice to people that they should maybe think about AI or think about their career, their next steps differently?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier in the conversation, the pace that we're on right now is, it's insane. I mean, if you look at image generation from a year ago to now, and then let alone, you know, what just dropped with, that was it, Sora and all that last week. And
crazy.
It's insane. Yeah. It's only going to accelerate, and it is scary too. So I would say that, I'm going to provide a rambling answer to your question, but basically, I don't think it's really possible to keep up with everything that's happening. And there's so many amazing minds that are working on so many different things that it's really easy to get fixated on like a specific use case. And, you know, building some tool, and then basically it's obsolete. So, and I've seen it happen myself. I mean, so I guess it was a year ago, I started playing around with these sort of chatbots, basically where you take, it's called retrieval augmented generation. I think that's what RAG stands for. Basically, you know, ChatGPT is kind of its own, let's say its own kind of black box, or it has been until there's, you know, now you can interact with the internet to some degree. But there are ways of basically taking a bunch of context, and then with the vector embeddings that we were talking about earlier, you can basically like have it pull from, let's say, all of Ernest Hemingway's writings, let's say, and you can say, you know, I want you to respond like Ernest Hemingway based on this, you know, this specific data set. So you build a chatbot. I made a chatbot just right around that was, I know we're not supposed to talk about religion, and I'm actually not.
It's okay. It's okay to mention it.
It's actually my friend said, hey, my friend who's actually Christian, he said, why should you make a Jesus chatbot? So I actually made one that was just for fun. It was like, it was called Just Ask Jesus. And you could talk to Jesus based on the Bible. And I'm not a Christian person, but I thought it was pretty cool. And people who tried it were like, it was pretty cool. But anyways, I was just messing around. But point being that I shut that down just because it was just like a little hobby thing. But anyways, point being, spent a fair bit of time trying to come up with a use case that we could apply to our business, so Vitao, and made a few things, and honestly nothing really stuck. I spent a lot of time just twiddling my thumbs in that respect, just building different things. In the end, I think, you know, now with, was it Gemini's context window? It's like a million tokens or something ridiculous. I don't remember the exact number, but it's ridiculous. Basically, now you don't I think very soon you won't need the, well, I'm not an expert at any of this stuff, but the expanding capacities of some of these large language models is going to make a lot of the stuff that I spent many, many hours messing around with pretty much obsolete. So my main point is, I think it's really good to stay on top of everything that's happening in AI because, you know, the vast majority of people are still very naive to the whole thing. So if you were like, you know, if you're just kind of casually a, you know, a armchair AI, you know, enthusiast, I think that you have, you know, you have an entry point to a lot of conversations that can be beneficial to new jobs. And I think a lot of more established businesses are going to be looking for people who are more informed than they are about this stuff. So even if you've just been paying attention for a few weeks and you're kind of just kind of exploring this stuff, you can be more of a, you know, you can provide more guidance than people might be able to do on their own. And I had a friend who's, she's a project manager, and that was, she's saying like, oh, what should I do to kind of level up my, you know, my, yeah, how attractive I am as a potential hire to new companies. I said, oh, you should do two things. One is you should definitely think about how you can combine AI with your, that current line of work. Cause think of all the project managers who are going to be looking for that kind of thing. And you should build in public your own skill set. So, like on Twitter, share what you're doing to kind of apply to AI to your project management skill set. So that dovetails into my point that I took a long way to get to, which is I think doubling down on relationships, human relationships is crucial. So network and also, you know, creating some kind of community around sharing what it is that you're doing is a real, you know, obviously there's the positive side. It's amazing to be able to interact like this with people and have a community. And then also it's a real, you know, life raft if things really go south. You have people who can go, hey, you know, I know you, we connected. Is there anything that, do you have a job for me? Any work I can do to help out? So I think doubling down on that stuff is huge. AI can't replace that yet. And then also just kind of definitely playing around with AI. It's definitely, yeah, I highly recommend it. It's can be very interesting, whatever you're into.
I think the different verticals that you mentioned could be so interesting. You know, AI and project management. And we just talked about AI and advertising ads. And specifically, you know, we can already do ads for YouTube, ads for Facebook, ads for Instagram. And then that's interesting because I used to be a project manager for a decade. I remember, you know, I was pretty good at it too. I remember just different spreadsheets, different ways of thinking and organizing a very, you know, complex project, not just simple one, projects, plural, and having them run differently in parallel. There's so much you can do. And I think, Ian, you totally hit it. The fact that human relationship, I think it's more important now than ever before. It's always been important, but now even more so. As of a few months ago, I was so stunned by like the statistics that somehow still 80% of the people have not even tried most basic elements of AI, like including ChatGPT, Open 3.5. It's free for anyone to use. Like, there are a large number of people who refuse to even log in and use it. And then I also have been in conversation with people within certain professions and kind of just like keep their blinders on to say, this needs to go away. This needs to be controlled, to be managed, to be eliminated. And frankly, to anybody who probably knows and while watching this, it's certainly too late now. So being that pioneer maybe within your own industry or just being an additional voice to teach people, this is what I've learned, this is what I've applied. And that's when you realize there are many gaps between what people think AI can or should do versus what it end up doing. And that gap is precisely where we can play a very significant role. And saving that whatever 10, 20% of the time maybe may seem insignificant to some people, but think about like 10, 20% of your week, 4 to 8 hours, just your, you know, work week. That is significant. You can do another side projects, like even based on what we just talked about. So I think they're, I like how open-minded and how some of these ideas are naturally flowing already. Super helpful.
Yeah, no, totally. It's really easy to get, you know, I've seen this with our team all the time where we think things are so obvious to us that they're not even worth sharing. And
exactly,
you know, we're head down what we do all day, every day. So It's take time to recognize your own brilliance and don't feel shy about sharing the stuff that you're doing. And I think that naturally attracts others. And yeah, obviously maybe some people are going to say, oh, that's such basic stuff. Well, fine. You know, that's cool.
Not for you.
It's not for you. Exactly. So, but I think sharing more, and I'm terrible at this personally. Like I have so many fits and starts on my social media personally, but you know, just on the whole, as our business shares more and more, I just see it's just the more human connections you can build. It's so much, that's where the magic happens.
For sure. Absolutely. It's interesting. Now I want to kind of go into the origin stories a little bit, because based on the people I interact with on a daily basis, which is very much worldwide, and Ian, you're currently based in Virginia. I know you're originally from California, and you are still, I think you're dual citizen here and Hungary, and that's super fascinating to me. And I notice like people who have a certain struggles, like for me as an immigrant in particular, you know, coming here when I was 17 and running around trying to look for jobs, I literally walk into the state house in Boston and will be like, I need a job, and ended up working with a mayor. It was so interesting. But like mayor's assistant as well, to see all the like these political issues and these petitions. I knew nothing about it. And I fell asleep at the courthouse because it was so boring whenever the debate was going on. But you become very resourceful, and then you look back and like, I will never, or like, why would I ever walk into the state house begging for a job? But I would love to hear your origin stories, and you know, I'm just wondering like how you grew up, and you know, if you had any siblings, did you have someone to look up to that always constantly kind of fuel these new ideas, these challenges, and you know, all these things into your little brain?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, your origin story is much more impressive than mine. But so I'm really fortunate to have sorry about that. That's
good.
Random alarm. That was nothing important. I'm fortunate. I have had two really good parents, and so I know a lot of people don't have that, and they're both pretty unconventional people as well. So my mom is an artist, and my dad was
like mine.
Yeah, no, I mean, your mom's just amazing work. It's incredible. It's so cool. And I was blown away when you showed me that last time. It's super cool. And my dad was a boat builder, actually. So he moved to California and then basically learned how to build boats.
Wow.
Like in a boatyard, and then he started that as a business, and then that's actually became, so when I was born, you know, that was where I lived. I was living on a little boat, my parents, and then they were sailing around, going to Mexico and with me and as a little tiny baby, and actually I don't remember any of that, because it was until I was about 3 or so. But so I grew up kind of around, you know, both my parents doing a lot of things and kind of in building things and just kind of a do-it-yourself, can-do attitude. Something that I maybe have picked up a little bit from them. But then I just, like, I was bouncing all over the place in terms of, I did pretty well at school, but I was really into sports, like baseball, surfing, grew up in Southern California, did a lot of surfing and around the ocean a lot. But I never really could find my footing academically. I did go to college. I played baseball in college, which helped me with my admissions. I mean, I didn't have terrible grades in high school or anything, but good enough to get in.
Wow, that's impressive. They're like on a baseball scholarship, basically.
Actually, it wasn't a scholarship. It was basically, it was a factor in getting into school. So I could have gone to an Ivy League school. So I guaranteed admission at Columbia, and I went on a trip out there, and I think it was about this time of the year. So it was like February, and I'd never been to the East Coast before, or I'd been to Georgia, so south, but never been to the Northeast. And it was so cold, and I was And I went on a trip to Dartmouth from there too.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful, but it was so foreign to me. I said, no, I'm not going to go here. So I stayed in California. But anyways, I took forever to finish school. I had a bunch of jobs when I was in college. I started working as basically a buoy. I was a buoy maintenance technician. So there's all these buoys off the coast of California that measure the waves and the weather.
Wow.
So I got a job helping a crew take care of those buoys. And then that led to my actual job that I got after college, which was a diver and a welder for this oceanographic institution. So we would survey the coast, and then we would build these pieces of equipment in the shop.
Mm-hmm.
So we would do a lot of, I learned how to weld and machine and things like that. I was not super good at it, but I did a fair bit of it. And I liked it. You know, claim it because it was really fun. And then we would dive underwater and actually install it. So we would install it in the sea and stuff. And so just got to do a lot of different things. And then at the same time, just, I wanted to travel a lot. So I did a bit of surf traveling and stuff like that. And then I had sort of I decided I wanted to go meditate and I learned how to meditate. So I left my job and then went and lived at a meditation center for a couple of years. And
where was this center?
It was in Central California.
So, okay.
Yeah.
A couple of years.
Yeah, I was there for almost 3 years. It was 2.5 years at least.
What did you do at this meditation center? I mean, this is serious. This is not like one weekend you decided to, go to Kripalu or something like in New York. So yeah, 3 years almost.
Yeah. So actually, I went on this pretty epic surf adventure to Indonesia. So I was sleeping in my office at the job I just described. So I was sleeping there and saving up a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to go to Indonesia, because Indonesia is one of our best places in the world for surfing. And I convinced my boss to give me 3 months unpaid leave. Mm-hmm. So I saved up a bunch of money to do that. And I went on this trip and it was incredible. I mean, it was just peak experience after peak experience surfing and just meeting people and just having a great time. But at the end of the 3 months, I was, actually it was 2.5 months in, I just had this, I realized I kind of did everything I wanted to do. Why do I feel so empty? You know, it's just sort of probably eat, pray, love type of.
What age were you at the time, if you still remember?
Yeah, I was 27, I think.
Okay. So
late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually cut the trip short. I said, I want to do a meditation retreat. I had a friend who did a Vipassana retreat, which is like a 10-day silent meditation retreat. So I heard about, I had done one at that point when I was 21. Mm-hmm. And then I came back. I didn't meditate one time after that. I just came back. Thought, that was cool. And then I didn't do it again. But my friend had done it. Had a really amazing experience, and I thought to myself, okay, you know what, this whole hedonism thing, I tried it, I felt like I went pretty at least for me,
mm-hmm.
did what I was trying to do, and for whatever reason it wasn't ultimately fulfilling. So I came back early from my Indonesia trip and did a 10-day meditation retreat, and then that kind of restarted this whole thing of I got really into meditation and spirituality and in a certain tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, okay, I'm going to keep working a bit, but I want to actually go all in on this. So I kept living in my office as long as I could and started saving more money. And then I actually quit my job and then this place and lived there for 2.5 years, just meditating a lot. I was also a groundskeeper, kind of handyman type of guy, but mm-hmm. just hours of meditation every day. And then we had retreats where I would, meditate for quite a while.
So I know that at the beginning, I was like, oh, we don't talk about religion. I just meant wasn't about one, not talking about as in one's necessarily then better than the other. That's what I meant, right? An argument, but it's not like we have to not mention it at all. So I'm curious, mm-hmm. When it comes to meditation, who was leading it? Was it a more California style? Was led by a monk or someone of such as Asian culture? I'm just curious.
I mean, it's funny because I wasn't intending this. So fast forward, I was in India and Bhutan for over a month. It just got back a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I have this hat on. So it's
oh,
so
no.
Yeah. So it's a fast forward, but and that's just because I was having a bad hair day and it was cold outside, and I just wore the hat. But I didn't think we'd be talking about this, but I'll happily get into it. Yeah, so basically it was actually an American. So basically there's a Tibetan guy who came to America and then spawned a bunch of American sort of Buddhist teachers from that. And so that was kind of the tradition that I was involved in at that point. And then it's basically Tibetan Buddhism, essentially. And,
gotcha.
But it was more from I would say there was no, that tradition had been sort of recontextualized mm-hmm. within American culture.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the context that I spent those 2.5 years was sort of like, but I didn't learn Tibetan or anything. It was all in English.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so that was that. And then basically one of the realizations I had in that 2.5 years was, I need to know how to make money.
I was going to ask about that next, right? Like it's meditating for 2.5 years and had very interesting jobs before. Okay. So now you're in your late 20s, 29, 30, and you needed to make money. Okay. We need to hear that.
Yeah. So I had an ex-girlfriend at that point who was, she'd been a nurse. And so she had an amazing lifestyle. So she would work like 6 months of the year in chunks. And then she made, you know, six figures a year. And then she traveled a lot. So I thought, you know what, that sounds really cool. So I decided I was going to go to community college and become a nurse. So actually I was on the wait list while I was at this meditation center waiting to get into being a
student.
So eventually they told me, okay, you can start class now to become a registered nurse. So I moved to LA and then I became a EMT. So an ambulance driver.
Mm-hmm.
And so, cause I thought, okay, I want to be in the action, you know, I want to be like flight nurse, like jumping out of helicopters.
And stuff. It does sound cool too.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really intrigued by all that. So I was an EMT. Which was actually really difficult. It was a really difficult process, even though I think a lot of people do it. For me, it was really challenging, the amount of material that we had to learn and skills and stuff. So a lot of respect to EMTs, all emergency medical people and nurses as well. So I was at nursing school for about a year while I was trying to be EMT to pay for it. And then my schedule was just so all over the place that I got fired as EMT. My clinical schedule from nursing school kept conflicting with my schedule and they could never schedule me. So they fired me. And then I had to drop out of school. And then basically my girlfriend at the time, who became my wife, she funded, she had student loans. And so about her student loans. And then I ended up randomly getting a job as a direct response copywriter, which is, which is basically like a marketing copywriter.
That's funny. That's the beginning of your current career, sort of.
Yeah, well, sort of, and it's actually interesting because while I was at the meditation center, I had this like real anxiety too about money because I was barely making any money. They're nice enough to give me like a very small stipend, but you know, I was in debt, like not huge debt, but I was like just hovering in the red pretty consistently. But I'd started just messing around with blogs and things because there was a lot of people making money with SEO blogs. So I would spend, you know, maybe like 1-2 hours a day playing with blogs and things like that and try to figure out how to make money on the internet while I was, you know, I'd be meditating for hours a day. But then it was like, I wasn't always in strict retreat. I would be, you know, doing housework and stuff like that. So
what year was this? Is it 2014, 2015? I'm trying to get a sense.
Yeah, this was actually 2010,
2011. A little earlier than that. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. That is sort of, I think it's really fascinating. 2009, 2010, there are a lot of early YouTubers who are now huge.
Yep.
I mean, some have left the platform, but that's almost like the wave of when it's about, it's still early adopters.
Yep.
That's fascinating. Okay. Please continue.
No, it's actually really interesting because I remember I had some sort of people I met in these different communities and they made legit businesses out of blogging and just doing affiliate links for fitness products and things like that, with blogging wheels and all like SEO wheels and all these different sort of spammy tactics, and easingarticles.com, if anyone's ever seen that.
Easingarticles.com.
It was this sort of content repository where you could basically, you make a nice piece of content and you point it at your site, and then it would throw some traffic at you. And at that point, if you did, like, let's say you did 20 content pieces, maybe one of them really kick off and actually throw a lot of traffic to you, just because they were indexed like crazy.
Oh, interesting. Wow. Yeah.
So I was kind of learning about all this stuff, as much as I could while I was, I'd say like the last year I was at the meditation center. And then basically, yeah. So I thought to myself, okay, nursing is my backup. I really want to make money on the internet. I had read 4-Hour Workweek when it came out.
Of course. Yep.
Everyone. And I thought, okay, this is how I want to live. I want to be, and I want to kind of be independent and all these things. So I lost my job, got a job as a direct response copywriter at a company that started out doing a lot of education products. And then it became a supplement company, cosmetics company, but they're experts at selling online, doing ads, email marketing. So I learned all these things. I learned like how to make web pages, how to use Photoshop, and how to write good copy, all these different things. Just kind of became a sort of MacGyver as best I could. And I fell in love with it. I thought it was so cool that you could make something on the internet in this sort of real intangible digital space. And then people will get value enough to pay you money and you can make, you can make a living doing that. So that became what I was doing. And then I ended up leaving that job for becoming someone's copywriting apprentice, actually, where I was writing all his ad copy, as his assistant, and that allowed me to work remotely. And that was huge. That was game changing for me to be able to work wherever and all that. And and then basically that led to eventually me starting this agency with, it was actually not an agency. Me and my business partner, Brat, started collaborating on a couple of projects, and then we got more projects, and then all of a sudden we had an agency. And then, that's,
the rest is history.
Yeah, that led to what we're doing now. So
I think it's something that you said in the end. I think we need to kind of quickly summarize or capture that. I hear a lot of people, especially in the internet age with AI, a lot of people saying, I want to hear more about starting an agency. I should have an agency. I am in the process of building one. But what you just said is you and your partner, you basically started this business. I'm sure it was a little challenging at times, unpredictable, but over time you figure out something that does work, word of mouth, and of course through advertising, it starts to grow, and then you call it an agency. I think we can actually take so much pressure off of ourselves, like saying, I'm starting a company, as opposed to I'm going to experiment some of these ideas. Let's see where they go. And eventually, as needed, you can hire other people. I also know like there are a lot of like one person, $1 million small businesses or small team businesses that are very successful these days without any headache. You haven't even heard about them at all. I think that's the most beautiful thing. Like one of the reasons Ian Y invited you to join this show is because I think most of people haven't heard of you or Vitao yet. You're running a successful company and you're having so much fun learning while doing this remotely, from anywhere you want. This is kind of the life that a lot of people would strive for, and yet they don't believe it's possible. That's why I really want to introduce some real voices to the show. So 1 hour flew by so quickly, Ian. What are some of the things that you want to still surface, talk about, or like want people to remember or take actions on before we wrap up?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I'm happy to chat for as long as the time allows. I'm down. So, but yeah, I think the main thing that you mentioned that is really the main thing that I resonated with that you just said is that, thinking in small bets and doing little experiments and not, it's so easy to get ahead of ourselves, and then imagining, oh, I'm going to have this big company or this, we're going to be doing this and this and this. And then there's a big vision, but what comes with that a lot of times is a lot of pressure that we put on ourselves. And I think it's really unnecessary because you really don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, I think it's good to take those big picture steps. For instance, just to provide some context, reason why we got into YouTube was I felt like YouTube was massively underutilized at that point. It wasn't a, it, there were people doing great as advertisers, but it was not to the extent that it is today. And I thought, okay, I think this is a huge opportunity. I want to learn more about this. And that led to me meeting my business partner and then us doing some projects together that then led to like a recurring situation where we built the team and everything else. But I think just thinking in terms of small experiments, being open-minded, having a big vision, so like stepping back, and then also like on the granular level, just what's the big vision, and then what's one small thing that I can do to see, you know, just to experiment and see how things go in that direction. And then not being afraid to say, hey, it didn't work. We didn't get to all the failures, but I spent so much of my own money failing stuff that never, you know, saw the light of day or totally fell on its face. And, you know, and also to this day, it's challenging. You solve the problem of, I want to work remotely or I want to have my own business and not have a boss. Well, guess what? I got 30 bosses now because I got a bunch of clients, right? I got, you know, 100,000 people on the email list that we want to serve and all these different things. There's always more problems. It's never like, it's not never a perfect situation, but.
That's true.
Yeah. So appreciate what you have too. You know, it's one of these things that we are, it's nice to have a steady paycheck too, especially when you have a team that needs to get paid and they got families that you've met and you know, wow, if we fail, then we're letting down all these people who we really care about. So it's always like,
yeah,
the grass is always greener and all that. But
yeah,
I'm rambling at this point, but basically I think thinking in small bets is really crucial, and you know, trying to have fun with it and also really paying attention to the spirit of the age, you know, the Zeitgeist, however they say in German, where things are going. And then also thinking about how you could apply that, how you can combine that. Don't be a bandwagoner. Oh, no, I'm going to do this AI thing abstractly. Think about, okay, AI, cool. What is my unique experience that only I can speak to? Because I think when you combine that with maybe the bigger trend, that's where you can find your own little zone of, you know, where you are the expert at that.
Yeah, zone of genius, they say that. Yeah. Oh, that's super relevant. I'm so glad that we kind of arrive at this point. And also, you know, I just want to call it out, you know, Ian runs Vitao, Inceptly.com. You know, these clients are really big. These clients are spending, you know, $50,000, $60,000 or more on ads each month. And whereas, you know, you're running a team for obvious reasons, and there are a lot of demand, there's big budgets come with, you know, bigger demands as well, and expected results. Whereas there's also another option, like running PhaseWorld. You know, my team and I, you know, it's a very small team. We don't have anybody full time. And it's mostly me, my producer, Herman, and my social media manager, Rose, my partner, Adam. And we have Anna, you know, help out as needed as well. So it's a really small team. And sometimes, to be honest, Ian, I thought about, like, for, I think in my 30s, I thought about like, scaling bigger, better, faster. And suddenly, I think since I was like, you know, bought this house, like, since I was 37, and I was thinking parallel moves, you know, some of the things, like, I'm really made for a smaller company where I get to be really intimate with my content and the clients I'm working with, including a lot of the AI companies these days. That's kind of my sweet spot. And what is the cost of me trying to scale, make it bigger, faster, better, right? Like, maybe it's okay. Like you said, it's okay for me to, I think this is the perfect, for now, this seems to be the perfect thing I'm focusing on. We haven't even had a chance to talk about your podcast. I do want to plug it real fast. Do you mind, like, shout out the name of your podcast and the people, maybe the guests you're going after on your show as well?
Totally. I mean, so it's nowhere near as good as Faith Podcast, but me and my business partner, we have conversations with the people, and it's a Zoom call. And we record it, and it's usually about advertising, sometimes about other stuff, but it's just Vitao Podcast. Look it up on YouTube. I think we have 1,300 subscribers. It's super small. It's nothing that we focused on. It's more about an excuse to just have really interesting conversations. And I would encourage people, I don't think that, you know, everyone's got a podcast now, but I don't think it's, don't worry about things being saturated. It's a great excuse to talk to people. And
oh, absolutely.
You know, like, just think about, I know, just talking to you, babe, last time and this time, I've had so many ideas based on what you said. And I think it's an incredible way to connect with people, and you never know what's going to happen from that. So circling back, you know, use the parlance. I think that's a good hedge in this AI age. Mm-hmm. Too. It's just, there are more chances you can have genuine conversations, and then record it, and then use space software to cut it up and
spot intelligence, yeah. Guys.
Yeah.
You were genuinely like plugging, not shamelessly, like plugging our different products. Sometimes, like you said, you know, people find this conversation interesting, even if 30 seconds or a minute that they find that truly resonated with them in that moment where they, you know, learned that one thing or made their day slightly better. For me, it's a win. I'm really glad that you mentioned that's an excuse to reach out to people, because otherwise, like these days, you know, on LinkedIn, I still get a lot of comments, DMs of, do you want to be my mentor? Or, you know, can I pick your brain? Things like that. Whereas this just feels more holistic and more interesting. You really get to know someone. And I'm sure, Ian, maybe reflecting on your origin stories, there are a lot of things that you haven't really put into words or in that sequence, that there was a good reflection for you as well. So I really encourage that. Recently, I've been in conversations with two of my dear friends who mentioned, you know, the challenge of monetizing a podcast, and therefore they really don't see themselves starting one, or they're just kind of no future for it. And then I kind of have to break into that conversation to say, like, look at the show that you did have for a limited period of time. Think about all the connections you had. I mean, that are ongoing. And so I think it's just a fantastic way for you, Ian. Like, it's not just having conversations, but you're introducing people to the business, you know, to your baby, to this, you know, really a pretty gigantic machine that you're running. I hope you'll continue to feel like it's a win-win for you.
Well, if I can, I just want to add something too as an encouragement to people. I think that, you know, so podcasts are amazing for the personal connections like we just talked about. And I do think that, you know, one thing I constantly kick myself for is I think there's also, it's great raw content for building your email list. Mm-hmm. So if you, you know, you're talking about something that other people are interested in, and there's some kind of adjacent business that is adjacent to all that, whether it's something you can advertise or something you actually provide yourself, you can repurpose this, especially now with all the stuff you described, like retrieval augmented generation. So RAG, there's all these things you can do, use space software, et cetera. You can make amazing written content that pulls from these conversations that you have. And then you have an amazing newsletter that you can, the content that you can put out. And then I just, you know, I know newsletters have really been, they've always been big. This last year, I think maybe there's a bubble. A lot of people are really thinking about them in terms of, you know, hey, I'm going to make a newsletter business, all these things, but I don't think it takes away from the value they provide. Mm-hmm. So yeah, business use case for podcast, have the conversation, use that to surface interesting content that you can then repurpose in an email newsletter and build up your email newsletter. You can send them content, send them offers. I was at an event right before I went to India in Texas, and there's a guy there. He skis most of the day. So he lives in Utah, chases powder, mm-hmm. everywhere. And he spends like 2 or 3 hours a day writing email to his list, mm-hmm. the health space. And he makes over $1 million a month doing that. And so, I mean, that's his business, is get people on my list, email them stuff, email them interesting content, and have a soft call to action to buy something. Mm-hmm. And they're not his products either. They're products that he recommends. So it's a super simple business model. And whatever your primary business is, I think that sort of type of mechanism can fit into. So that's my spiel on why I think podcasts are also a great great thing to have in your business.
For sure. I mean, we're talking about content at the very beginning of this, and kind of circling back to that, especially if people were just getting started, to say, I really hate or fear facing an empty room, a page that I don't know what to say, having another person, like a friend or a guest or someone you want to learn from, you find interesting, to have this like a ping pong back and forth is so much easier. And, you know, some people say, I'm not super proud of all the pieces of content. I think we just need to take it easy on ourselves as well. Like, totally. We cannot, right, like, treat every micro content as if it's the Netflix sizzle reel. Or, you know, some people are like, I know micro content needs to be like a trailer from a movie. Well, it's really not. Those trailers take millions of dollars to make. Yeah. And, you know, there's only one or maybe two trailers per a 90-minute or 102-hour film. That's not really what micro content is for. I wish, like, we're not so polluted by popular media and thinking about what we see and how we need to reproduce that. Like, you just need to stay true and authentic to your content, and you start to experiment. Right? That is so essential. So I hope we're being like really raw, honest, and vulnerable during this conversation to encourage more people to join in. Please feel free to ask us any questions in the comments. Learn more about Ian's business, VidTao. And just, you know, there's a free version, so sign up and see how you like it. So with that said, Ian, I think we went a little over time. I think it's super worthwhile. I can't wait to start producing micro content out of this and send it to you as well to check it out. We can repurpose on both our channels. And with that said, I'm going to take us offline. Bye, guys.
Thanks, Faith.